My guest today on Research Matters is Professor Henry Frendor. Professor Frendor has been a full professor of modern history at the University of Malta since 1992. He's the author of several books, chapters in books, journal articles, reviews, editorials, as well as television and radio productions. Professor Frendor previously served with the UNHCR in various capacities in as diverse places as Switzerland and Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Egypt, and also Papua New Guinea. His main areas of research and interest are imperialism, nationalism, decolonization, post-colonialism, journalism, migration and ethnicity and identity in Central and Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean, the Middle East and North Africa, especially since 1798. He's also very interested in the relationship of language to nationality, culture and statehood. And at present, Professor Frendor is director of the Institute of Maltese Studies and chairman of the Malta University Press, and he also chairs the Refugees Appeals Tribunal. Welcome, Professor Frendor.
Oh, thank you very much.
Of course, that was a very limited, rather reductive description of your full biography. But obviously, with the time at our disposal, I couldn't go into everything really. At least that gave a taste of what I've been doing these last years. Clearly, I haven't had the opportunity to read all your books, and there's quite a list of them, and some of them are real doorstoppers. Your book on statehood is a very thick volume.
That went into a second edition, and it's just about sold out in both editions. The Origins of Maltese Statehood, the Case Study of Decolonization in the Mediterranean. I was the first person to get hold of the archives in London as soon as they became accessible. So a lot of the information in it is originally, in every sense, you know, people didn't know a lot of things. I didn't.
That's a wonderful thing. When a certain number of years pass, then they can open the archives.
30 years normally.
30 years. So that's for the historians. They'll all be waiting there, like praying mantises.
Well, I actually had an arrangement with the director of the archive
to let you in immediately. I can imagine. I really like to listen to you talk. I've been to several of your talks and lectures, and I particularly remember the one you gave on the Upper Baraka about the Maltese-Portuguese connection, and also the one at Saint Anton Palace where you were talking about the 1802 Declaration of Maltese Rights.
The bicentenary.
That was it. Yes, yes. That was it was a revelation to me. In my ignorance, I had absolutely no idea about this declaration, and so I found it very interesting.
It's an important document, it's a historic document, because it reveals many things. Among them, the fact that among the Maltese elite, you had quite advanced and mature juridical understanding of right. And constitutional right. And I think it is also interesting because it shows traces of the American Declaration of Independence and of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. So at least two earlier revolutionary postures in America and in on the continent, which had seeped into the forma mentis, if you like, into the disposition of the Maltese elites, many of them lawyers, but not by any means exclusively lawyers. And when they talk, for example, in the Declaration of Right, the Maltese Declaration of Freedom of Conscience in 1802, of the right to property. And that the government has no right to confiscate property, which is the Roman notion, of course, of ownership, since unfortunately mutilated beyond recognition in this country. And that if property is confiscated by the state, this cannot be done without adequate compensation being given to the owner. and that everybody is equal before the law, and that there should be no arbitrary arrest. You know, these are notions.
Advanced notions, aren't they?
1802. And then, of course, what is extremely important in that declaration is the fact that they are objecting to what is perceived to be tantamount to an usurpation of trust, which had been vested in the British by the Maltese at the time that they were fighting the French with great difficulty and at great cost, when they had asked for their protection, on the assumption, rightly or wrongly, that they were entering into some kind of a pact whereby the British would be protecting them, but then the Maltese would be entitled to have their own popular council and so on. And that declaration in particular was an immediate reaction, an immediate response, and a very articulate and eloquent one, to Article 10 of the Treaty of Amiens in 1802, wherein the powers, at the end of the Second Coalition, decided, as Article 10 of the treaty, to give Malta back to the Order of St. John, which had abandoned the island without a fight only 2 years earlier, 4 years earlier, without consultation. So they said, basically, listen, they put into question the notion of sovereignty. We asked for British intercession on the understanding that they would protect us and respect our rights. If the British are not interested, we can take care of ourselves, and we will decide ourselves what to do with our country. So it's a thinly veiled presumption of the right to independence and sovereignty in extremis, because they are with their backs against the wall. But certainly they don't want the order back, because they had been let down by the order.
As we only, unfortunately, have a short time for this discussion, I thought we could dip into the latest research work that you've been involved in and you've published in these last months. And perhaps having mentioned already the Maltese-Portuguese relations, perhaps we could you could tell us a little bit about the article which appeared in the 30th anniversary edition of Storia.
Yes, Storia is the journal of the Malta University History Society, which we had started. I was the first editor. I still edit it, actually, in 1978, when the late Professor Andrew Vella was the professor of history at that time. We had chairs. And we had started this journal partly to encourage graduates and undergraduates interested in Maltese history to write articles in it, which has happened, and this was the 30th anniversary edition. It's almost unbelievable because, as you know, in 1978, I had resigned and left this university for reasons which are well known, and so had many other colleagues, some who never came back, others who repatriated from the emigration, for better or for worse, such as myself. What I did in my own little contribution to that, apart from the editorial, to this 30th anniversary edition of Storia, consists of the address which I had given in the Upper Baraka, for which you were present on the occasion of the unveiling of a marble plaque in recognition of the assistance which Portuguese troops and engineers had given to the Maltese insurgents in 1798 and a little later, between 1798 and 1800. And the interesting thing in this article now, which is a revision of the original address, is a manuscript which had been buried, which I found about from Paul Schwierer, the former librarian, which had been buried in somewhere in the Melitensia section of the library for decades. It's an eyewitness account by a Portuguese engineer who had been sent down by Admiral Denizza, who was in charge of the Portuguese squadron, and who actually was on the ground with the Maltese leaderships in the insurrection, advising on positioning and provisioning of batteries, on strategy, on tactics, and who gives a detailed account of the batteries, the locations, of attempts which the Maltese leadership were intending to undertake, but which he strongly advised against because, you know, he felt he was afraid this, they could lead to a massacre. And also the constituent elements of the various Maltese battalions from the various localities, the sort of equipment they had or did not have, the sort of munition they had or did not have. So it's quite a revealing account of the insurgency and starting on the 2nd of September. In fact, we opened the plaque on the 2nd of September. It was the 2nd of September 2008, 200 years later.
In fact, the discovery of a piece of eyewitness account for like that for a historian must be like, you know, Christmas coming early.
Well, yes, for the historian and also for the benefit of the general public. I am not a collectionist, you know, so it's not as if I gather data and lock them up in my drawer. Some people like doing that, you know, like numismatics, or the numismatists. Or the, whatever I find, I try to decipher and digest and then try to divulgate as intelligibly as possible. Possibly relying a little bit also on my past journalistic skills, which helps to sell books. Because the way in which you write, the way in which you expose a situation, of course, if it's in a run-on fashion, then it makes it makes for easier reading by the general public as well.
Definitely. I think that's one of the very good things about your history books, that they are eminently readable, in actual fact.
I remember a comment which a friend of mine had passed after the publication of Party Politics in a Fortress Colony, the Maltese Experience, and she said she had read it on the beach. Now, this is quite a scholarly book, which is now out of print, the second edition is. The third edition has come out in Italian, and I have a request for a German edition. But she said, I read it like a novel.
Well, I think that's definitely a compliment. I know that you are particularly interested, as we had said in the beginning, about migration of Maltese to various shores around the Mediterranean and also beyond, of course. You have an article in the JMS, the Journal of Mediterranean Studies, on migrant settlers in North Africa during the 1930s. Tell us something about that.
That's the latest edition of the Journal of Mediterranean Studies. And this is research which I conducted at the Bibliothèque Nationale de Tunis. Much of it is in French, the original, as, but there's also some stuff in Italian and occasionally some Maltese and some English as well. And I was looking in particular at the ethnic press in Tunisia in the 19th century, of which you know, there are quite a few publications, newspapers mainly, which are very revealing. But one newspaper in particular which I looked at, because I have every reason to believe that the leading light of this newspaper, the intellectual, shall we say, mastermind of it, was Laurent Ropa, who is an extremely intriguing novelist, originally from a Gozitin family who settled in Algeria. But he spoke Maltese, he understood Maltese, he wrote in Maltese, but of course he was Frenchified. And so we have this paradox where you can sense and you can see evidently, manifestly, the association of identity, of ethnicity, of sustainability with the language and its literature. But on the other hand, you can also see the strong impact which context is having on what one might call the authentic, original, initial Malteseness, if you like, you know. So, for example, the appeals to speak Maltese. Parlez français, parlez maltais, in French, you know. And you find the same in Egypt, where there's a very strong, very active Maltese community since the early 19th century. and they tend to use English. They use Maltese as well. Even in this Tunisian newspaper, Tunisian-Algerian newspaper, which is published from Sousse, the director is a Maltese, Mifsud, I think, from Sousse, in Tunisia, you know, you tend to get some Maltese, but there is always this equivocal duality, which I think is very present in today's Malta as well, with English. Of course, before the war, it was with Italian. How far the situation has changed, this duality has changed, this tension, this confusion, if you like, as well, you know, is a moot point. But certainly, these people clearly identified themselves as being of Maltese ancestry, and the elite, at least, they're rather, you know, proud of it, and this, they felt that it distinguished them from other migrants. It distinguished them also from the native Arab populations in Algeria and Tunisia and in Egypt. But in all cases, you will find the influence of the various empires and the consulates, of course. Malta was not an independent state, so everything depended on the consulate. You had to go to the consulate if you needed a visa or if you needed anything. So the French, British and Italian influences in North Africa on this movement to try and retain an ethnic identity through language, literature, and otherwise, and shared memories and history. Also very interesting, I found, is that it coincides with the kind of renaissance in the Maltese language and literature in the 1930s. Because in 1934, Maltese, in 1931, you had for the first time a standard orthography of Maltese in Malta Talada. Then in 1934, you had for the first time Maltese established by the British, ironically, as a national language. The sort of thing they wouldn't have done in Wales, you know.
Colonialism, of course, is as you were saying, it's one of your main interests, of course, and you have. The book Colonialism and Colonialismo e Nazionalismo nel Mediterraneo.
That's just come out.
Just come out. And I think that this is really an extremely important book because this is a Maltese researcher who is talking about a general theme of the Mediterranean. It's published in Italy and is going to be launched now. As a publication by a Maltese researcher and from the University of Malta. And I think that's absolutely wonderful, both for you personally and also for the University of Malta.
Well, it's quite flattering, to be perfectly honest, that the rector of the University of Urbino, who is a historian, a modernist and a contemporary historian, actually, will be just about launching it. Yeah, he'll be chairing the ceremony, which is being organized in the last week of October. And various other academics and intellectuals have been invited to it. The Deputy Prime Minister may be coming up for it, actually, and certainly the Ambassador in Rome. Now, it's one of the very few works of this nature, of this genre, you know. This is about the British occupation. It's updated to 2008. I even have Joseph Muscat here in the list, in the scheduled list of all the parties, factions, alignments, and party leaders who, you know, have graced the Maltese scenario since the 1870s. But it's in Italian, and quite frankly, I think that there is not very much at all published in Italian of this kind. So it also gives access. So it's quite a big market, you know. Hundreds of millions of people throughout the world speak Italian, read Italian. It's taught as an important subject in various universities in North America, in Australasia, even in Britain, Italian studies. So I see it as a penetrating an area of knowledge which had been, certainly to me, on the outside.
Well, I think the idea of as I say, a researcher publishing abroad is extremely important from various angles, obviously from the academic angle. I mean, it introduces the university and yourself to a very wide audience, and hopefully then you will then create even more contacts, and your networks will be widened, and the name of the university will be known further afield.
Well, this is the University of Urbino. In fact, they've already asked me if they can not have a closer relationship with the University of Malta.
Exactly.
Yes, unfortunately, Malta remains a fairly insular place, and the space in the newspapers, in the Sundays particularly, in my opinion, is not growing, may even be becoming smaller. Unfortunately, it's a very sad reflection on contemporary Maltese society. For works of an intellectual nature, of an academic nature, which have a direct bearing even on our country and on our society. So they tend not to be so well known at all in Malta. But we just cannot continue to pander simply to the local audience, to the local market, which, whether we like it or not, is very limited. This week, I was informed yesterday, actually, and sent the all the details. I had an article published in London by the Journal of Imperial and Commonwealth Studies, which is the leading world journal in this area of study.
This is the Australian Press Perspectives of Lord Strickland's Malta.
Yes. That's an article which was researched almost entirely from Australian sources in Australia, to which I've had access. I've been to Australia a number of times. I used to live there, of course. It's interesting for more than one reason. First of all, because why would the Australasian, because I include New Zealand with it, and the Australasian press be so interested in reporting about what was happening in Malta when Lord Strickland was its prime minister? Sir Gerald until 1928, then he was raised to the peerage in 1928, so Lord Strickland after that, and of course he was prime minister from 1927 to 1930, and more or less in harness, indirectly, if not directly, as an advisor to the colonial government until 1932. The reason is partly because they remembered him when he had been a governor of three Australian states, which were Tasmania, Western Australia, and New South Wales. And Strickland was governor of New South Wales, which was Australia's prime state, really, although Victorians would argue with that, until 1917, when he fell out with the elected government, the prime minister particularly, and fell out with London, as it were, and was just about recalled, which is why he came back to Malta. He tried to become a governor somewhere else where he preferred, but it didn't work out. So he came back here and went into politics. So the Strickland article in the Journal of Imperial and Commonwealth Studies is not just about reportage of goings on during, shall we say, what I call Strickland's Malta. It didn't belong to him, but from 1927 to 1932, when a lot of things happened. But it's also about flashbacks to the time when Strickland was governor of Australian states. So if something happened, for example, I mean, this is a major article, but just as a little example, if something happened in Malta which had a resonance in Australia, for example, the quarrel which developed between Strickland's party in office and the Catholic Church in Malta, led at the time by Archbishop Maurus Caruana, who came to Malta as an Anglophile, suspected of being pro-British, having been in Scotland for many years, trained in Scotland and so on. But this was not enough to stop a political, religious, or church, state, struggle, whatever you want to call it, anyway, personalized ad hominem as usually. So of course they reported about this, but they also reported about comparable incidents which Strickland had had already when he was governor with the Archbishop of Sydney, with the Archbishop of Melbourne, and comments, for example, which the Archbishop of Melbourne passed about Strickland, you know. So it's a meeting of worlds, really. I think it gives new insights, completely new insights, on Strickland himself.
Absolutely. In the last minute that we have at our disposal, I'm seeing here this article, or chapter really, in a book called Hide and Seek, Faith, Culture and Dialogue. The influence of religion on multi-society past and present. I think that this sounds too fascinating to leave on one side.
It's published by the Movement Cattolico Studenti Universitari, MKSU, and it's edited by Mark Farrugia, who I think is a philosophy student. It's quite a bold attempt at combining secularism with faith, and faith with reason, and trying to chart a path ahead for believers and relations of believers to non-believers. Now, the chapter which I was asked to contribute is on the influence of religion on multi-society, which I called Past and Present. This was originally a paper I had given in a Ruskin College seminar held at the university, Ruskin College and the Malta Labour Party Young Socialist League, in April 1977. But I revised it and updated it for this publication. And it's about the nature of religion as it has been practiced in the Maltese Islands, a rather conventional and a rather fanatical expression of religion, which has also become embroiled repeatedly in politics, partly because politicians also make use of religion, using terms, politicizing terms, which would have normally had a religious connotation, but which are then used and confused with political personalities, you know, like referring to a political leader as a Salvator or a Redentor, the Redeemer. So there are various examples of this sort of discourse in the article. But then I updated a little bit, you know, by referring to the influence of secularization with tourism and opening up, especially after independence. So that for example, after 1963, tourists swimming in bikinis are no longer arrested on the beach. Although I mentioned a case of a young lady who was apparently sunbathing topless in a remote beach last year, who was arraigned in court. So it's changed. That's yeah, not all together.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Henry Frendo.
Thank you very much.